Our subject today is guilt, with particular reference to youth, but recognizing that youth are simply a strong expression of people, and therefore human beings only more so. We have today two parallel trends, one in psychiatry or psychotherapy, and one in religion, which correspond. The psychiatric trend is a trend toward personal responsibility. It is antagonistic to man as a product of cultural or biological forces that he is imprisoned by. It's a trend that's anti-Freud, anti-psychoanalytic, and has its correspondence in the religious trend given great impetus by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, against cheap grace, which is against the kind of religious assurance which says, all you gotta do is believe. They don't like the words, all you gotta do. Again, therefore, I would appeal to personal responsibility to take hold and put forth. Bonhoeffer says a grace that doesn't cost anybody anything, including God, doesn't change anybody either. Even corporate guilt comes down to individual responsibility. Arthur Miller, who goes along with this in the drama field, says, in After the Fall, in every heart there is the accomplice to every crime, every evil. Corporate guilt, but, says Miller, one must bear his guilt alone. Death and guilt are alike in this respect. They're individually oriented. We all die, but it's a very individual experience. We die alone. So when one is guilty, he shares the common guilt, but he's guilty alone. And this very aloneness isolates him from the very group with whom he has the uncommonness of guilt. In fact, I would say the basic issue in the emotional isolation that we have today is guilt, because guilt estranges man from God, man from himself. This group conflict with the individual bothered Freud tremendously, and he expressed this in his Civilization and Its Discontents very strongly. That's a tract of his. Well, he seemed to think that the group was the enemy of individuality, that the group was that which made us feel guilty because of this corporate guilt, and therefore isolated the individual from the group because the group's pressures were so strong that the individual couldn't live up to them, or if he did live up to them, he denied his selfhood. And Freud then saw man as divided into an id, which had a strong, impulsive nature of expressing immediate feelings, that would be the individuality, and the superego, which is the group imposition of standards by which the person can be accepted by the group, which he can't seem to live without, and finally the ego, which has to handle these tensions and is akin to the self. Eric Byrne, who is an analyst also, but departs from this rather impersonal division and ties all these issues into one's personal life history, so that the id becomes that most spontaneous part of it, the child, our child, the child I was and am. And the superego, which is the, you know, restraining influence, that's the parent. Yeah, no more of that, that's enough. Come on. Not a parent, but my parent, my parents. And the adult, that's the ego now that has to come forth and assert itself, posing a third force into this now triune situation. And we need all three, says Byrne, because the balanced person knows when to be a child, when to be a parent, and when to be an adult, an objective, analyzing, data processing individual who looks objectively at things. Now, guilt keeps us fixed to the past. Because we feel guilty over what we've done or haven't done, or what we are or are not. And in that sense, according to these positions, cannot be broken. So we might be released from the past until this guilt has been evaluated by one's position in his own family situation, clarified in terms of his personal and family origin. Now, the leading anti-Freudian voice in America today, at least I think he is, would be O. Hobart Mauer, who's written the book Crisis in Morality, Crisis in Religion in Psychiatry. And Mauer's resistance to Freud is based on this, that one's guilt is somehow or other inhibiting influence to one's individuality caused by conforming pressures. And Mauer says this is for the birds, that guilt is real and has not a purely subjective, relative basis. One of the men who follows in the Mauer tradition, but as I think quite a bit beyond him, William Glasser, who's written a book entitled Reality Therapy, says he tells people when they come to him as a psychiatrist with their guilt and how guilty they feel, he says, well, you probably have very good reason for feeling guilt. Both of these men insist that one must withhold forgiveness from such people. Withhold forgiveness from the guilty, because all that forgiveness does is relieve them of the responsibility of atoning for their guilt. And say these men, they must atone, they must make reparations, they must work out their guilt in redemptive action, or they are not assuming their own responsibilities. Now, this anti-Freud note has hit a responsive chord in our culture. It's hit a responsive chord among the secularists. I don't mean that by a negative. I mean among culture as a whole. Because I think as a culture, we're tired of Freud. We've been dominated by him and by Darwin for so long that we're tired of him. I expect a revolution against Darwin one of these days, too. When Glasser's book came out, the Saturday Review of Literature gave it a big billing. And the editor of the Saturday Review of Literature wrote the review and said that this is the way he felt. Down at Freud. It's hit a responsive chord also among the clergy. Because Mauer is pro-conscience, and so is the clergy. But Mauer's conscience, as I'm afraid some clergy do not realize, is the Word of God. Not that which is evaluated by the Word of God. And where Mauer says that Freud, along with others, Mauer didn't say this, Mauer says that Freud said, that's correct, that religion is nothing but the projection of the Father image into the universe on the part of those who don't feel grown up enough to do without it. I would say about Mauer and his corrective of Freud that his religion is simply the projection of the individual conscience in the universe and calling it God. And then of trying to appease it in a very impersonal way. There are a lot of games that people play with guilt. This is the day when we talk about games people play. I would suggest that the game we play with guilt might be called Outwitting the Parent. I'll add that to Burns' collection. The child outwitting the parent. There's a certain naivete, I think, in our sophisticated culture today, whereby we still think that what people say is the gospel truth. And so if somebody says, I have no guilt, we say, oh, he has no guilt. And this is the day when people say, I have no guilt. Mickey Rooney says, on my 8 marriages, I have no regrets. Seems to be kind of a blow to one's pride, you see, if one admits he has any regrets. Sort of a sign of weakness. But actually, guilt is showing up very much today. in terms of the symptom of self-destructiveness, which is running rampant. I'll give you an example now of a pastoral counseling situation with a young woman, 21 years of age, who, at the time she came to her pastor, was in quite an emotional state because she had sabotaged a relationship with a girlfriend that meant very much to her. She had attached herself to this girlfriend. They were both living away from home, working girls, and became very jealous of this girlfriend and other friends, particularly a boyfriend. And when another girl moved in with them, she tried very hard to make it a two against one. And whenever she became the one, she became very difficult to live with, and finally destroyed the relationship that she seemed to have, and they suggested she move out. And this is when she came to her pastor. But as she talked with her pastor, and he allowed her to express her possessiveness toward this girlfriend, her jealousy of her, and how she had destroyed the relationship through these things, a sense of guilt began to show itself around the edges. And when he encouraged her to express this guilt, it seemed to be that there must be something wrong with her, that she had this great need for this girl. And when he encouraged her to be a little more explicit, her specific guilt was, "Am I a homosexual?" Well, after he got it out and relieved her from the condemnation of labels, she began to see that what she was concerned about as homosexuality was simply an immature sexuality. That this young lady, and by the way, that's what homosexuality in adolescence normally is, and in young adulthood, that her, let me put it this way, like any other child, she both wants to become an adult and is afraid to become an adult. And the adolescent change from childhood to adulthood has a strong ambivalence connected with it. An ambivalence which most adolescents will not let anybody of the adult world know about, and I don't blame them, in the sense that one wants to be an adult, and therefore the fears about the responsibilities of adulthood are hidden. But with this young lady, her family life had been rather chaotic. She was the youngest in a long line of children of a family that was split up. And so her attention from mother and father was minimal. In fact, what was in extent was negative. And she really had never fulfilled her childhood. She was hung up there still in the childhood situation, and her relationship with the girlfriend was typical of an age group of the past. But she had passed the past. Her puberty had come and gone, and here she was hung up in the sexual development because she was hung up emotionally, hung up in her development from childhood to adulthood because she hadn't fulfilled her childhood. Yet her guilt was not a guilt that had any motivating power. All it did was fix her to the past. Might even say it chained her to the past. It was a negative pressure that fixed rather than freed. So her struggle was really a struggle of growing into her own adulthood and her resistance to it. After several sessions, her pastor thought that he needed to confront her before they could make any progress. And he said, and we'll call her Betty for want of a better name, "Betty, if you could do and have what you really want, you know, take all the should I and shouldn't I out of it, what would you want?" "Well," he said, "I'd want my girlfriend back." "Well," he says, "I guess that settles it then." "Well," she says, "what do you mean?" "He says, well, this is what you want. I'm certainly not going to stop you." And she paused a bit, and she said, "Well, I wouldn't want that the rest of my life." He says, "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, I would like to become married someday and have children of my own. Maybe that isn't what I want." And then she began to realize that with a horrible moment, she was free. The game was over. There was no more child outwitting parent. The parent had said, "You're free." at the concluding session, and she showed considerable progress to the point where she was ready to step into the adult world. In her reflections with her pastor, she said, "I think the turning point was when you asked me what I would do if I could do what I really wanted to." She says, "I never thought of it in that way." What way had she thought of it? What can I do that's forbidden? Freedom is wonderful, but it demands responsibility. What the pastor did was relieve the negative pressure of guilt. The negative pressure that comes from a child outwitting the parent. So that one realizes one's outwitting no one but oneself. And then she faced the future in terms of this freedom. There was no parent to outwit. There was no way to stop her or protect her. And that spoiled the child versus the parent game. Now, this realization of freedom, however, came after she had relived her past. And that's very important. Relived her past with her whole being. And that's more than simply telling about it. That's reliving it in terms of all the emotional accompaniments that went with the events she was talking about in the relationships. Reliving plus freedom together release the conflict from that internalized authority figure which perpetuates the estrangement between oneself and one's own self, one's own being. Reliving illustrates the role of confession in reconciliation with oneself, one's neighbor, one's God. At Wartburg Seminary, each year I had a member of the AA, Alcoholics Anonymous group, address our senior class. And after this happened many, many times, I said to him on one occasion, "I feel, you know, rather odd in asking you to do the same thing every year." Oh, he said, "Don't feel that way." He said, "I get more out of it than I give." He said, "Each time I tell my story, I die a little more to it." What he meant, of course, and this is one of the secrets of the AA movement, is that this story of the past was filled with guilt and anxiety. And every time he relived it, it became that less frightening, that less guilt-producing, and he had to do it again and again and again. Because when the conflict is deep, this sort of reliving may need repetition. And when it's very deep, the pastor may have to resort to a type of role play within the counseling relationship to get it released. For example, without going into any specific situation here, imagine a situation where a young person is rather blocked in expressing his or her feelings, say regarding, well, let's say a parent. And the pastor or the counselor realizes that this is a very strategic area in helping him, but there's so much inhibition that reliving is blocked. After there's a sufficient rapport and there have been enough sharings to make this kind of thing possible, the pastor or the counselor may say, "Now you've told me enough about your father that maybe I can take his part for just a moment and pretend that I'm your father and relive this rather difficult experience that you've had a hard time telling me about. And then after we do it, you tell me exactly the thoughts and the feelings that are in your mind." And of course, this brings it right up to number one, present tense. And we try then to get out in the present moment that which was blocked in a past moment so that the present moment can relive therapeutically what the past lived destructively. This is one of the purposes of group therapy, to live out in a wholesome group relationship relationships in the past which were not wholesome, in order to live out the wounds into healing. This amounts to reliving in terms of reenacting when reliving itself is blocked, to get the feelings to the surface and identified. Much blocked guilt is over hostility. We have a difficult time dealing with hostility. And then it latches on to other things that are safer. One of our students at Wartburg Seminary, on one occasion in the advanced class of pastoral counseling, asked me if I would give him a tough assignment. And he was kind of a tough-minded guy. And I took him up on it. I said, all right, I have one in mind. There was a certain lady in one of our mental hospitals there who had frustrated every pastor and every student that I had sent her in the community. And she had at this time 65 shock treatments over the past decade. And she had a psychotic episode in the hospital to the point now where she was placed in what we would call a custodial care unit. And it looked like, since she was in her 60s, that was where she was going to stay, or some other kind of custodial home for the rest of her life. Well, she had frustrated about 6 students in a row, so I said, here, take it. Good, he said. I gave him the background, he didn't flinch a bit. So nothing happened, of course, that gave him any happiness for several weeks. Her point was that she had committed the sin against the Holy Ghost. But she was a very pious woman, very conscientious and pained in her religious depression. And he'd say to her, what makes you, instead of saying, like we're always sucked into saying, well, if you're worried about it, you haven't committed it. Oh, she felt good after that for 5 minutes. And she was worried about it. That's why she had visited all the pastors. They always told her that. So she felt good, and they felt good, but what means of going back to them, because 5 minutes later she didn't feel good, she went to another one. Well, anyhow, instead of saying, well, then you haven't committed, if you're worried about it, he asked, what makes you think you have? She shook her head. Well, after about a month, she said, instead of shaking her head, she said, well, the thoughts I have. Well, what are these thoughts? She'd get up and go to the door and look outside. He said, are you afraid somebody might hear? Yeah. So I had to let it go. So spring came. He took her out for a walk in what was a very large campus. He got right in the middle. He said, well, look, can you see anybody? He turned her around. Not nobody could hear us out here, could they? One of those thoughts. So he said, if you can't say them, do you suppose you could possibly write them? For the first time, she didn't shake her head no. So he was quick. He handed her a pencil. But unfortunately, he didn't have any paper. But there's enough of a gesture that it moved her, and she opened her purse and took out some Kleenex. And then she started to write, and he was quick again. He looked over her shoulder, and this pious, Christian, over-conscientious, sweet little lady was writing, God damn you, get the hell out of here. And all of a sudden, she looked up, and he was looking at her. And she about died. She took that Kleenex, put it in her mouth, and he's in Ezekiel style, swallowed. And he looked right at her and smiled and said, I saw it. You're really angry with me, aren't you? I'm pressing you too hard. And that was the beginning of a new relationship. But he didn't hear much about the sin against the Holy Ghost after that. That story's about 8 years old. That lady was getting no other therapy. I'm not saying what this did. All I'm saying is she was getting no other therapy. She had no good prognosis. And for the last 7.5 years, she's lived a pretty independent existence in the city of Dubuque. For some people, however, hostility may be a substitute for guilt because their guilt is blocked. They're much quicker to criticize others. They're just naturally hostile people. They bristle with it. They belong to the Zophar Club, if you want to go back to Dr. Frost's lecture. They attack others to avoid confronting their own sense of inadequate and worthless selfhood. Now, whichever negative emotion is easily expressed, that's usually the one that can be a cover-up for one that isn't so easily expressed. The anxious person expresses fear very easily, anxiety. And in our culture, this is a pretty dominant anxiety. We've been called the age of anxiety. And as we have mentioned yesterday, we are also the addictive society, and our need for tranquilizers and barbiturates indicates how anxious we are. But this anxiety, you see, may be also hiding a sense of guilt and hostility that's much more difficult to express than the anxiety. The very critical person, who's always hostily lashing out at everybody else, can very well be covering up for a sense of guilt, where their real hostility is toward themselves. The depressed person seems very guilty. They can't say anything too mean about themselves. They're worthless. This may be a cover-up for hostility that they cannot countenance toward others, which is now turned toward themselves consciously. Guilt is revealed currently, as church youth research shows us again and again and again, is revealed currently in what may be called the low self-image. A sense of inadequacy, of worthlessness, of emptiness, of life without purpose, without meaning, that which is behind the anxiety of meaninglessness, the low self-image. And this has a very strong hold on the personality. This is why confession or reliving within a relationship may need redoing for renewed reconciliation, since life is dynamic, going on. In plain language, we can't count on yesterday's victories to fight today's battles. Guilt has an habitual character about it. We can become at home with it. You know, it's familiar ground. Virgin territory frightens. And may be frightening to be without that which we've been living with so long, even though we hate it and it's painful. Guilt may be habitual because so often it's used as a sense for controlling us. I mean, I'll confess, as a parent, I don't think I can avoid it, that I use guilt motivation to control my children. I use it to control my students, if I can control them anymore at all. If I can control your conscience, if I can make you feel guilty, I can control you in the most effective way because I've got a hold of your insides. The moralists have known this for a long time. It's what might be called the internalization of the parents within us. This kind of habitual guilt is also caused by our predisposition to inability to do what we feel or know we should do. This is one of the dialectic factors in the doctrine of original sin. The good that I would, I do not, and that which I would not, that I do, O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? I am impotent. It's a continuous source for guilt. But that alone wouldn't do it. I don't feel guilty over something that I have no responsibility for, that I can't do anything about anyhow. Not just impotence, but to a deep-seated ambivalence. This is the other dialectic factor in the doctrine of original sin. Not only am I impotent, the good that I would, I do not, but I am devious. I am a betrayer. The good that I would is also the good that I would. That's what I feel guilty about, that I'm insincere. That I play games with God too. I think the most severe guilt I've ever encountered as a pastoral counselor comes when one sees this factor in himself. That he participates in the corporate guilt of hypocrisy. The low self-image leads to self-sabotage because it's a form of self-punishment. Guilt as pain, and guilt is painful, can itself be the form of punishment it demands. So can confession. If you confess, you just, you know, you lower yourself and you let yourself be lambasted, as it were, you lambast yourself. This too can be a form of the punishment that guilt demands. And this was why also it may be frightening to let it go. It's part of the payment. I need to punish myself by feeling guilty and confessing my guilt. A safety control system, that if I'm in charge of the punishment I know I deserve, then God doesn't have to take charge of that. It's the old idea that I remember as a child, when I got a splinter in my hand and my dad got out the needle to take it out, I'd much prefer to have handled that needle myself. Anything but to fall into the hands of the living God. And if I can keep this debit credit ledger balanced, that's a safety control system. But all this is a distortion of the constructive purpose of guilt. Guilt, constructively, is a tension which is a sign of life, to bring about growth, improvement, to close the gap between the way things are and the way they should be. Removal of this kind of guilt should be frightening. We can't say that the Christian gospel, the atonement of Christ, removes guilt. This is ridiculous. This would make a tension-free life, and the only thing that I can think of that's tension-free is that which is characterized by the word death. Were there no guilt, there would be no movement from where I am to where I should be. And people who have no conscious sense of guilt show little indication, you see, for change or for growth. They're on the plateau, and any awareness of what a plateau is in terms of personal development means it's on the way down. Destructive guilt, on the other hand, fixes the gap between what we are and what we should be by dividing up the person into the self he condemns and the self he tries to show to others. Now, outwitting the parents, this fascinating game, is actually fascinated by the forbidden. Saturday Evening Post ran an article on marijuana smoking in colleges, and quoted one young lady who said, the reporter asked her what she got out of this smoking pot. And she says, well, it's hard to know, but I feel just like I'm eating candy before breakfast.
Very good. Never could eat candy before breakfast. Outwitting the parent.
This, in a sense, is what Betty was doing, the young lady we talked about at the beginning. It was wrong, and therefore attractive. Did God say you couldn't eat of that tree? The day that you eat thereof, you shall be as God, knowing good and evil. The adventuresome appeal of that which is forbidden. Fascinating. The challenge in growth is to become one's own parent of the child of the past, to use the language of another man by the name of Misseldine. And this, in a sense, is what Betty did. She became her own parent of her own child and became an adult, and thus could deal with her parent as adult to adult, since she had become adult. This would be called the maturation of guilt. It's what is meant by becoming an adult, specifically what is meant by becoming adult in religion. The example of our predisposition to destructive guilt, I think, is in the area of the sexual and its subsequent fascination. What is fascinating about sexual forbiddenness is the fact that it is hidden, concealed, covert. I haven't made any exhaustive studies of nudist colonies, but I don't. From what I gather, there's no great problems of morality connected with them, because there's nothing hidden. England has a law that any woman can appear on any stage naked, providing she starts out naked and doesn't move, and nobody's interested in that at all. No, there's a certain game one has to play called striptease. The game of concealment. The fun of getting away with something, you see, of outwitting the parent. It's behind the bar, and that's the important thing. Basically, I think our guilt over sex is due to the fact that it's a betrayal of intimacy. That one is withholding oneself in that which is a demonstration of an apparent union, whether this is in fantasy or in actuality. And the exploitation of the other person, whether in fantasy or in actuality, leads to isolation from others. It's a manipulating of others, whether in fantasy or in actuality, rather than a loving of others. And this produces guilt. The maturation of guilt here is necessary also. It means that we must assume responsibility for the concealment. That one is outwitting only himself. That one is also, in his development into adulthood, also his own parent. Now, Maurer's critique of the Freudian-dominated approach to guilt is that in Freud there is no parent. There's only the child. In other words, there's no objective basis to right and wrong. There is simply this relative conflict between the group mores and my individuality. There's only the child. And that's why, in Freudian thinking, the child is so important. And why childhood experiences are so important. And why the recovery of childhood spontaneity is so important. And I might add that there's something very close here in conjunction with Christianity's emphasis on, except ye become as little children, ye shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Guilt is real, says Maurer. There is a parent. That is, there is a reality beyond subjective manipulation. Things are right and wrong, you know, whether I want to think so or not. Because my conscience won't be manipulated, really. I can only bury it. I can't really change. So there's no parent, and we're all child, and we can dismiss all the judgments, all the guilt. But Maurer goes away from Freudian indulgence to end up in what I think is a legalistic severity where there is no child. There's only a parent. I don't think you correct one extreme by going to the other. Both of these approaches miss the gospel. They miss grace. Maurer's attack on cheap grace is really an attack on grace. Christ's atonement is bypassed for our own atonements. The projection of the conscience into the universe instead of the Father image is really no improvement in my thinking. The behavior then is to appease an impersonal deity of my own subjective deification. Where there's no God beyond the self, then you have either all child or all parent. And I see both in Freud and in Maurer no God beyond the self. Therefore, there can be no dialogue, only monologue. We see these corresponding alternates in honesty, which is the child, and commitment, which is the parent. Either one alone is a distortion. Honesty, how much we hear about honesty today. This is the day to be honest. Everybody's honest. And it can be a real source for pride and egotism. At least I'm honest. Well, fully for you. It's another way of saying I thank God that I am not as other men are. I'm no hypocrite. How more hypocritical can one get? Honesty is also, you see, a means for cruelty and indulgence. And no matter how many fine things we say about the child, religiously or analytically, children can be very, very cruel. Honesty can simply be a justification for being brutal. I tell people what I think, and I stand up straight when I do it as they lie wounded all over the landscapes. Commitment, on the other hand, can be a source for repression. A refusal to face discrepancies, a refusal to think and to reflect, a refusal to face the questions involved. Don't ask such questions. Faith is something to believe, to question. Everything then focuses on what should be. And anything that contradicts what should be is looked away from, pushed down. Commitment itself then can be also a means for self-justification, just like honesty can. I believe we should only believe and not question. Well, only for you again. Here the parent, and in quotation marks, parent, this is caricature, of course, the parent, is a paragon for doing what is right. Now, I see in the Garden of Gethsemane a union of these two. Jesus said, "Father, if be possible, let this cup pass from me." You know, that's a horrible prayer. Here was one who, in his own words, came to suffer and die. And here he is on the very eve of his fulfillment, at the edge of the promised land, and he wants to turn back. He says, "There's giants out there. If the thought of evil is sin, then Jesus is not without sin." Because he had the thought in his mind to bypass the cross and even pray to God that it could be done. Obviously, then, temptation is not sin. And I think there's entirely too much guilt among young people over temptation. Because what did Jesus also do? He faced the ears. "I don't want to die on that cross." And then commitment came in. "Nevertheless, not what I will, but thine be done." And out of this frank confrontation between what he wanted and what he felt obligated to be, he got the strength to do what he knew was right. Here the is and the should are accepted rather than one blotting out the other. Jesus' identification with the Son of Man, to me, centers right here, most clearly, in that he identified with this conflict that we all have between what should be and what is, in a very existential, painful way. However, in our lives, the pathway seems sometimes to be from a fear-dominated denial of the self, where there is no is at all, only what should be, and to throw this all off in a freedom from all domination as an illusionary self where there is only the is and no should at all. That would be complete rebellion. To finally a commitment as a free person to Christ and becoming one's own real self. And this presents the is, what really is, the reality, in wholesome tension with what should be, so that guilt again can be restored to a constructive tension. And that which restores it to that is nothing other than reconciliation between what I am and what I should be. And that comes to me in the cross. Now, the key to the outcome may be in the pastoral care in regard to the guilt. Besides reliving for releasing, we also need new doing. And here I take my key from that great theologian, Casey Stengel. Casey Stengel said, and I will not go into the Stengelese here, I'll translate it. When he spoke about Ron Swoboda, he says he only has one trouble. When he gets mad, he thinks only about the last play instead of the next one. That, to me, is a description of destructive guilt. Commitment needs to go into action. It elevates one's self-respect, one's self-image, relieves guilt. When I put my reconciliation into the next play, and enter the next play with the resources from the past and the reflection over the past, a reflection that I can only do when I'm reconciled with the past. The anonymous alcoholic group also assumes responsibility for other alcoholics. The redeemed alcoholic immediately goes into action as a redeemer of alcoholics. This may be a means, you see, of becoming a responsible person. Those who receive shall also contribute. This is a gospel principle. Freely you receive, freely give. The Apostle Peter, after his denial of Christ on that breakfast beach in Galilee, confessed his sin, was reconciled to Christ, and then three times told, feed my sheep, feed my lambs. Go to work. The Apostle Paul confessed over and over again his sin in regard to Stephen. He was reconciled to God over it, and in his own humble words, labored more abundantly than they all, even though it was the grace of God in him. Gratitude needs expression. Paul Tillich said, more people are sick today, not because they haven't received blood, but they have no concrete ways to give it. We are created to contribute, to be creative persons. And this is what elevates our self-image after reconciliation initiates the process. Behavior, our behavior, both expresses and activates our soul. In other words, we're both recipients and contributors to our own identity, our own development. Well, thank you for your kind attention. I have a break now.